Coming up on Path to Zero.
Just over the last decade, we've added 50 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere that wouldn't have been there if we had been acting a decade ago.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. Would you agree that the science of climate change is complex? If so, count me in as being in agreement with you. Both wrong information and changes in measurements can sometimes make it hard to separate fact from fiction. Our guest in this episode is set out to present the most accurate scientific information in a way that's accessible to laypeople. Joining us is internationally known theoretical physicist Dr. Lawrence Krauss. He's the author of hundreds of articles and numerous popular books, including New York Times bestsellers, The Physics of Star Trek, A Universe from Nothing, and then his latest book, The Physics of Climate Change. In a book review, The New Yorker described The Physics of Climate Change as the ideal book for anyone interested in understanding the science of global warming. Dr. Krauss received his PhD from MIT, and then he moved on to the Harvard Society of Fellows. He taught at Yale, Arizona State, Case Western Reserve University, and then between 2007 and 2018, he was chair of the board of sponsors of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. He's currently president of the Origins Project Foundation and host of the Origins Podcast. Dr. Krauss, it's an extraordinary pleasure to welcome you to Path to Zero. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be with you, virtually at least.
Looking forward to today's talk in so many dimensions, but let's start. In your book, you really talk about an experience you had in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, where it kind of all came to you, and I think was the basis for your decision to write The Physics of Climate Change. What inspired you there to write your book?
Well, you know, there were a lot of things. I had gone there in some sense to see the impacts in a way. I led a little expedition of a group of people, but it's when it became personal. One of the problems with climate change, it often seems so remote to people and so well, not only in the future, but so grand that it's hard to localize it. And when I saw the wonderful culture and people who had, let's face it, overcome two incredible, awful wars and genocide in the 20th century, and come out of that as prosperous and vibrant individuals and cultures, and then to think about the fact that they were being threatened by something much more devastating over which they basically had no control, it was particularly sad to me. The thing about the Mekong Delta is, in some sense, it's a perfect storm for climate change. We tend to think of the impacts of climate change in many places as far in the future, but the Delta is one of the most vibrant rice producing areas in the world, and it supports probably the food and livelihood of 50 to 60 million people, and it exists because the river basically keeps out the sea and it floods the rice fields. But the entire part of South Vietnam, essentially all of South Vietnam, is less than 1 meter. In most places, less than half a meter above sea level. And we are guaranteed to have at least a quarter of a meter sea level rise in this century. And as that happens, you're going to see that rice producing area turn into mangrove swamps if we don't do anything. And that will have a tremendous impact. And so seeing this area that is just on the cusp of disaster and meeting the people really brought home to me. And it's one of that combined with the fact that right after I came back is when the pandemic hit. Literally, I left Vietnam the day the first case of COVID was announced in Vietnam. And then I was in a unique situation to be able to write like I've never been in before, because everything around me was canceled.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think in studying you a little bit, we know you've written 11 books, but you're quick to say that this one took you the least time to write of all 11. Why were you able to write it so quickly?
Yeah, well, you know, it was. In fact, and I now can say I've written 12 books. I just sent off the manuscript about 15 minutes ago to my publisher of my 12th book. But it was hard for me to remember. I thought to myself, how could I have written that other book so quickly? My books have taken me generally between a year and 3 years per book. This one took me about 10 or 11 weeks. First of all, I kind of had thought about exactly what I wanted to say, although, like most of my books, it requires a lot of learning. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth writing books if they'd all become the same book. But literally, every bit of travel, the town I was living in was essentially closed, like it was for many people. I was inside, and I was thinking about first responders and other people who are doing something useful. And I thought, what could I do that might be useful? I did two things. I recorded 25 little physics videos, but I thought I can write this book and maybe do something useful for the world. And so I worked between 15 and 18 hours a day on writing nonstop, which is something I've never been able to do because I've always worn many hats. And I was able, as I say, I couldn't believe within 10 weeks the book was basically done. And it was like many of my books, I have to say, I don't remember writing them. It's kind of like labor. I think if women remembered labor more, they wouldn't have babies a second time. And I think if I remembered how hard it is to write a book, I wouldn't write another one. So I tend to forget it. I often write late at night. It was an amazing experience to be able to delve in without any distractions. And as I say, I kind of knew where I wanted to go. And also, like many of my books, they take me in different directions. It's when they write themselves in different ways. And it was fascinating for me, you know, each book presents a challenge. It was fascinating for me to think about the fact that I could write something that wouldn't be just a terror story, and actually is fascinating science. But I was really motivated mostly by a friend of mine, a well-known magician in Las Vegas, in fact, who's not a climate denier, but who has often said, I don't want someone telling me what to do. He's kind of a libertarian. And he said, I just want to know what the situation is. And I've discovered I've lectured a lot on climate change and other controversial topics. And I've discovered if you start suggesting policies, then people suddenly close their mind if they don't like those policies. They say, I don't want my livelihood to be affected, or I don't want the government to get involved, or whatever it is. And they don't listen to the details. So I thought if I wrote a book, before we can do good policy or even consider good policy, we have to know what the situation is. And if I could write a book that just described the science and then said, look, here's the science, here are the issues, here are the predictions that are solid, here are the predictions that are speculative, then maybe people could use that to develop sound policies based on their own politics and their own decision of what the priority should be. So I wanted to write that kind of book, which was a very different kind of book than a policy book would have been much harder, I think. But in this case, the science was not only clear and fascinating, and as I said in the very beginning of the book, I've written, you know, climate change isn't rocket science, and I've written books about rocket science, so I should know.
So I want to talk about the book and the content, but you lead me right to a question that I might as well ask now. I know when the book was written, you sent a copy of it to every member of Congress. What were you trying to do when you did that? And then what was the feedback?
Well, the idea was, hey, here, look, I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat or independent. Here's the data that you should know, but here's something. First of all, I didn't expect the Congress people to read it. I hope that their staffers would read it. I've testified before Congress at one time before the House Science Committee, and I've lectured for congressional staffers numerous times. So I was hoping that I could try and take the political heat out of this whole, you know, add some light and get rid of the heat and say, here, look, I'm not telling you what to do, but here at least you know what the situation is. And I thought, and the fund, we raised money for it. I run a nonprofit foundation, and we thought that this would be a public service. What happened? Well, two Congress people and their staffers contacted me as a result. So I suppose it was a success in some ways. Now, whether it had an impact in other ways, I don't know. But I only heard back from two of them, and I guess that's not surprising to me. It's going to be a long, hard road to get politicians to be willing to think about what what the real case is, and not and put their put their political strategies aside.
Well, let's talk about those physics for a moment.
Yeah.
Your book, certainly titled "The Physics of Climate Change." What are the physics of climate change, and really, what global physical imbalances are we currently living in?
Well, you know, the key thing to realize, and this is what's important for people to realize, is, you know, everyone thinks about these models and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and all of the supercomputer models, and they become suspicious about whether they're accurate or not. The point is that the fundamental physics and chemistry of climate change is 200 years old. It's fundamental science. It's in some sense high school science. It's not in dispute. It's well understood. Now, of course, if you want to understand the fine details of how climate may change differentially across countries and how ocean currents will be affected, sure, you need supercomputer models. But the fundamental science is really quite simple. It's often called the greenhouse effect, which is a misnomer, as I try and talk about in the book. You know, everyone's been in a hot car in the summertime, especially people living down south, and you know how hot the car gets, which so you shouldn't leave your dog or your kids in it, because what happens is the sunlight comes in, but the infrared radiation can't get out through the windows, and it heats up the car. That's only a small part of the reason a car or a greenhouse gets hot. The other part, which is more important for a car and a greenhouse, is the air is kept inside. You have a real barrier. You can't have an exchange of air. Well, that's not what happens in the atmosphere. And so people often say, oh, you know, this is that argument doesn't work. But it does work in a different sense. The atmosphere acts like a blanket in a very clear sense. The physics is really simple. It is a simple equation. If the Earth isn't going to heat up, the energy coming in from the sun must be equal and opposite to the energy Earth is emitting into space. If it isn't, if the more energy is coming in than going out, the Earth is heating up. If more energy is going out than coming in, then the Earth is cooling down. And what happens with increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is it turns out the really important stuff is happening at the top of the atmosphere. You increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and what it does, and you can measure it very simply, is it produces less power being emitted from the surface of the Earth's atmosphere than was before. And so in watts per square meter, the Earth is emitting a little bit less energy. And that less energy, when you consider the entire surface of the Earth, means there's a lot of energy being stored in the Earth that wasn't there before. In fact, the number that I like best to describe it, which I think brings it home to people, is the amount of extra heat trapped in the Earth over the last 25 years due to that additional carbon dioxide and the storage of energy in the Earth has heated up the oceans by about 0.04 degrees Celsius. That doesn't sound like much. But when you consider the whole ocean, it's enough energy, the energy equivalent of 3.4 billion Hiroshima bombs exploded in the ocean over the last 25 years. 5 bombs per second, every second of the day, 24 hours a day. I don't know if any way that was clear, but that's the effect. And it's very simple. It's basic. Now, the details of how that extra energy and how that extra heat gets distributed around the Earth and gets and the impact of it on everything from ice sheets to ocean currents, that those details require more careful modeling of the atmosphere, which we can do. But there are, again, there are some basic impacts that don't require any modeling whatsoever. And I was surprised by them as a physicist. I didn't realize, you know, I know sea levels are rising, and I used to think it came from the melting of glaciers primarily, or the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet or Greenland ice sheet. Well, in fact, at least for most of the last 25 years, the effect is much simpler. Again, high school physics. You heat up water and it expands. And we know how much heat we added in the oceans, and we've added over that time. And we know, therefore, independent, even if we turn off all cars and carbon dioxide generating machines in the world today, the oceans, just due to that extra heat, are going to expand and produce a quarter of a meter sea level rise by the end of the century. There's nothing we can do about that. That's already written in stone, or literally written in the water.
Fascinating. So you talk there a lot about greenhouse gases. You talk about CO2. Is CO2 the problem?
Well, yeah, I mean, CO2, I mean, CO2 is the initial
measure, and that what we need to talk about.
Well, the CO2, the increased CO2 is the initiator of the problem. The unfortunate thing is that it can generate, it can produce a lot of other things that enhance the problem, like methane, for example. There are huge storehouses of methane in the permafrost in Siberia. And methane is actually a much worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And, you know, if you release a great deal of that, then it'll have a much more significant effect in the near term. But the other reason, I think the other thing I want to say, which I think most people don't realize, they say, okay, look, this, you know, there's a greenhouse effect or the world is heating up, but it's not going to really have a significant impact for 50 or 100 years or 1,000 years. Why do I have to care? Why do we need to act now? And the answer is something I think I called in the book, or certainly I've called it in lectures, what I call the Las Vegas effect. Namely, when it comes to carbon dioxide, what happens in the atmosphere stays in the atmosphere. And that's not true for methane, but it's true for carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide that we've pumped into the atmosphere, 10 billion tons of it, of carbon, 10 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere every year, year in, year out, over at least the last 30 years, and this year as much as any year before it. Of that, 5 billion tons stays in the atmosphere and will stay in the atmosphere for 1,000 years. And when you remember that before the industrial era began, the total amount of carbon in the atmosphere was about 600 billion tons. We've been adding 5 billion tons a year that's going to stay there, 10 billion tons total, but 5 billion of that gets absorbed in the ocean and into the earth. So 5 billion tons that remains in the atmosphere. So if you think about it, oh, just over the last decade, we've added 50 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere that wouldn't have been there if we had been acting a decade ago. And that's the problem, you see, because we're trying to stem off a heat increase in the atmosphere of temperature by a degree or 2 or 3 degrees Celsius. And every decade we wait, that goal becomes harder to reach. And that's the urgency. If we had started this, just think about this, if we had started cutting down the carbon dioxide production on Earth 30 years ago, because we certainly knew it was a problem 30 years ago, that would have been 150 billion tons out of 600 billion tons originally of extra carbon that wouldn't be there now. And that's the issue. We're quickly getting close to the point where no matter what we do tomorrow, we will have already added enough carbon in the atmosphere that an increase in temperature by 2 degrees Celsius will be impossible to stave off. We've already increased the world's temperature by 1 degree Celsius compared to sort of the beginning of the 20th century. And so that's the urgency. It's that it's what we put in today stays there and will stay there for our children and our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren.
Dr. Krause, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com. Maybe I'll win 6x0.
Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Lawrence Krauss, and we're talking about his new book, The Physics of Climate Change. As you speak, it makes so much sense, but it also speaks to such a global issue, such a complex issue. When you lecture, what do you tell individuals they should do? How does an individual respond?
You're right. I mean, that's a really good question, because the problem seems so daunting that we basically each of us would say, well, what can we do? I mean, what can I do as an individual? Well, of course, you know, you can try and cut your carbon footprint. And it may sound trivial, but of course, if all of us cut our carbon footprint a little bit, that will have an effect. But it seems to me much more important than what we can do as individuals is, first of all, learn about what the problem is. Learn, separate the facts from the wheat from the chaff, the facts from the falsehoods. And that was the purpose of my book. So you can, we can all, and as I say, anyone can understand this. It's high school science, and I think we should all be able to understand it. But once we do, we can act most effectively, well, first in the ballot box, but secondly, by either becoming active in the community, in our churches or our schools, or trying to get local Congress people to listen. Because governments don't lead. Whether they're, on the whole, whether they're democracy or dictatorship, governments don't lead. If you have a significant fraction of the population, and that I mean 2 or 3% of the population that thinks this is a serious issue and needs to take action, governments will act. So I think that what individuals can do, besides, of course, trying to reduce their carbon footprint, which we can all do, is to educate themselves and then educate their neighbors. I mean, now one of the reasons I wrote the book also was to so that other people could gain enough knowledge that they could talk to other people with some degree of credibility and explain what the problem was. So all of us, you know, I've often said that one of my favorite quotes is, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I'm an educator. And I think education is the key point. When we can educate enough people, I guess I kind of have faith that the public, when properly educated, will realize that this is an issue that they need to take seriously. And more important, they may need to make sure their legislators take seriously. Until we do that, governments are going to go on with business as usual. If they don't feel that inaction will lose them votes at the ballot box, you can be darn sure that inaction will continue.
So it's interesting. A lot of the things you're talking about, and we need to act now. I find so many of the solutions in play are so long-term. Even the creators of the solutions are quick to say, these aren't solutions for 2030 or 2035. These are solutions for 2050. Yet we bring solutions, use more propane today, use more natural gas today, lower carbon intensity than most any solutions. Sure. Use less coal today, use less diesel fuel today. By the way, one of my messages, how about conserve today? How about use less water, use less energy, drive less miles?
Well, you hit it perfectly. If there's no magic bullet, you know, yeah, I think that's a really point. If everyone says, what can we do today? Well, that we can do many different things. Conservation is a key part of it. And we also, the other thing, you know, there are the deniers on one side, and then there's the people on the other, who the hyperbolic doomsday people, who I think are equally worrisome, because, you know, that people basically hear them cry wolf, and then there's some on the left who say, oh, your kids are all going to be dead in 10 years. And then, you know, when that doesn't happen, they lose credibility. We have to realize that this is a problem, and it's a serious problem, and it's happening. There's nothing we can do about the fact that it's happening. But what we can do is think about rational ways to try and lessen the impact, to try and ultimately resolve the long-term problem, but also to realize that we need to take action to mediate things. Because your point you made about using natural gas, some extremists will say, no natural gas because it's, you know, it's fossil fuel burning. The point is, if we can convert worse fossil fuel burning into better fossil fuel burning that generates less carbon, then we should do that. And of course, as you pointed out, getting rid of coal is a key issue, and it's become a political issue in spite of the fact that coal results in very few jobs. And we could get rid of all the coal mines in the country and we'd lose, you know, maybe 20,000 jobs. It's really, but of course, in Washington, it becomes a serious issue. But we realize we have to take baby steps, and we can do many baby steps, not just conservation, not just converting coal to natural gas or propane or some other thing, but also another equally important thing, which again some extremists are against, is to make sure we don't close our nuclear power plants that work. And in fact, we can create nuclear power plants that are safe. One of the big problems with nuclear power, it's got a bad rap, there were many poorly designed nuclear power plants, but we know how to design safe ones. And even the unsafe ones, if you look at them, take Fukushima, right, which was probably, again, a perfect storm of stupid design, designing a reactor right in an area with tsunamis and earthquakes, and then making the cooling system at sea level, where it's likely to be flooded, I mean, even that stupid, stupid design, if you look at the number of people who died in Fukushima, far less than die any year in a given year due to the pollution from coal-fired power plants. So we have to look at many different ways to try and address these issues.
Embedded in that, you use some of my favorite words, but you talked about not one solution. We tend to often talk about wide path. You said there's no silver bullet. We always say there's only silver buckshot. So I love that. But I want to talk a little bit about the Origins Project, because I have so many questions to kind of lead on by that. But tell our listeners what you would like them to know about the Origins Project and, frankly, the Origins Project Foundation.
Sure. Thanks for letting me talk about it. I created the nonprofit foundation. It built on something I'd done when I ran an institute at my last university. I think it's very important to connect the public with thought leaders who are driving what will be the cultural and scientific changes that will impact on the 21st century, that will change people's lives. And in my old foundation, I ran scientific conferences, and then associated with each of the conferences, we'd have a public event so people could hear firsthand from the horse's mouth the people who are driving the important issues from not just climate change, but the future of physics or important issues related to xenophobia, et cetera. And so I wanted to continue that. And the other goal that's been a key part of my life, of all of the 12 books I've written, has been to connect science and culture. There's a disconnect in our society where somehow you can be cultured and be scientifically illiterate. And it shouldn't be that way. Science is a key part of every aspect of our life, and all of the important decisions that are going to, from energy to environment to safety to medicine, all the key political issues that are going to impact on our lives in the 21st century. But more than that, the ideas of science are some of the most fascinating ideas that people have ever come up with. And it's a tragedy that people don't understand what's going on. So I wanted to create a foundation where we could connect science and culture and provide people a way to interact with the greatest scientists and public intellectuals in the world. And we do that in a few ways. One, we run a podcast, the Origins Podcast, where I have people from Nobel Prize winning scientists to leading writers and actors and directors talking about how science and culture relate. And it's been amazing to have people from the comedian Ricky Gervais to, as I say, Nobel Prize winners in physics and other areas of science. The podcast we just released last week was on the history of life on Earth, the first 4 billion years of life on Earth, and it's kind of remarkable to hear about. And I just recorded a podcast with one of the world's leading primatologists, trying to understand how we can understand the human condition by looking at chimpanzees and bonobos. So that podcast is one enjoyable aspect of a video podcast that we run, and we run it out of and there's a subscriber base which helps fund the foundation on my Substack site. But we also run public events. We're running two events in November in Phoenix, which is where the foundation is centered, but eventually we'll be, I hope, run events around the world. One on sort of with Richard Dawkins on evolutionary biology, and one with five of the world's leading cosmologists on our understanding of the universe, two important areas. And the last thing we do is we actually run travel adventures, which, like the one that we ran to the Mekong, to help people not only see firsthand some of the most important areas in the world where key science issues are, and the Mekong obviously is climate change, but also spend a week or two getting to know and meet and talk to on a really personal basis some of the key scientists and public intellectuals in the world. We had Richard Dawkins and a key climate scientist in Richard Somerville in the Mekong. We're going to have Barry Barish in Greenland in September, where we can actually go and, again, try and look and see the impacts of climate change in Greenland, try and see Greenland before it becomes green, literally. But at the same time, learn about things like the Northern Lights and some fascinating science with Barry Barish, who won the Nobel Prize in physics recently. And we're also, by the way, going to have an additional event trip in Iceland right after Greenland, where we're going to visit the world's first real working carbon capture facility that's aimed at capturing carbon from the atmosphere and putting into rock. And it's doing it on a commercial basis. It was developed by some physicists in Reykjavik. We're going to visit that facility. It's not open to the public. And then we're going to have a public event that night where we talk to the people involved. So there's a three-pronged approach to trying to do that, and running a foundation is a challenge, but it's I think it's important because exciting people about their place in the universe and sort of motivating to think about that, and in certain cases motivating them to act on important issues, well, it's the best thing I can do as a scientist, I think.
Well, the thing that I really wanted you to share, and you did touch it, and that fascinates me as I studied it a bit, is you come to us as a credentialed scientist, for sure, but you are quick to note that the follow-on is much larger than science. It's about human factors, and it's about economics, it's about the arts and humanities, it's about an understanding of that whole physical system, and if we're going to solve even a scientific problem, we have to do it in a way that's much larger than science.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, science, as I said, science impacts on the global issues that are going to impact us in the 21st century. But that impact cannot be at all important unless at some level we communicate what our knowledge tells us about and communicate to the people who can do something about it. And those two sets of people are the public and eventually government officials.
Right.
And, you know, as you say, I tried to connect to the government officials directly, but I know enough to know that's hard. But if the public gets involved, that's really important. And as I say, it's not just a matter of doomsday and gloom. And it's these there's a lot of optimism about what we can do. And also, I think the science is fascinating. And I, from my experience with the public, when you explain things to the public in a way they can understand, that aha experience is almost orgasm. People love it. And I'm convinced, in spite of the fact that TV media producers and others don't think that science sells, I'm convinced when I interact with the public and they learn everything from not just climate change, but to the secrets of the universe from the beginning to the end of the universe, they're amazed and energized by that learning experience.
I was going to ask you, and I think you just answered it earlier, you do tend to believe that carbon capture is a part of the solution, is one of the tools in the solution.
Well, look, I'm not sure. I think it's really, at this point, it's very impractical. Right now, even trying to get the cost down to $100 per ton of carbon, that's a goal. Okay, but we emit 10 billion tons of carbon a year, right? And so $100 a ton, you know, multiplied by 10 billion is $1 trillion. Okay. And that means now it used to be that $1 trillion was a lot of money. Maybe it's less money now than it used to be, but that's an incredible challenge. Plus, you know, the amount of area you'd have to implement it for that kind of carbon capture, something like the area of Texas. So it's impractical now, but of course, what's really important is research and development. And maybe with the right kind of research, we can not just bring the cost down, but maybe figure out better ways to do it. I think it's, as I said, I think it's a long shot, but if you consider the amount of money spent on that bit of research and development versus, say, the $60 billion or so that's spent each year on oil and gas exploration, it's a pittance.
Right. All right, we're going to start wrapping up. So we have a little bit of fun, and then we give you a chance to make a couple of final statements. But here on this show, we always use magic. We're going to give you a magic wand. You can wave it to wish for one thing. That one thing will have the biggest impact on climate change in the next year. So one wish, short term, how would you use your magic wand?
Well, I was going to do a magic trick for you. I have one on my desk, but I'm not going to do that. It's not as significant as the magic wand. If I had a magic wand, I'd make carbon capture practical, efficient, and because in the long run, we know exactly what the cause of the problem is. And the solution, long term, is to bring down the carbon abundance in the atmosphere. And so, the magic wand would be to wave it and suddenly make a new discovery that allowed us to efficiently and economically take that carbon we produced, remove it from the atmosphere, and store it deep in the earth. But that's magic right now, not reality.
But it's an excellent use of your wand. All right. The other thing we love to do is we plant a tree in your name in a national forest. I know you're in Canada today. But is there a place that you would love to have a tree planted in your name and in your honor?
Well, I guess since I'm now on the East Coast, I used to be on the West Coast in Oregon, and there's lovely forests up there, but there's lots of well-managed forests up there. I think I'd like to do it up in one up in the New England area, one of the national forests up there.
Well, we will pick a national forest in the New England area. There's some beautiful ones. I was hiking not too long ago in Vermont myself. So we'll be glad to get back to you on that. All right. So now an important part for our listeners. I know that you can buy The Physics of Climate Change on Amazon, a lot of other online booksellers. I have to ask, we hear that you read the online audiobook version yourself. True?
I have done it. I've read all of my books that have gone on audio. I've read myself. I think it's very important. I don't think an actor could understand the issues enough to know what to emphasize and not.
That's so interesting. What else would you like our listeners to know other than where they can get your book and maybe a little bit more about the Origins Project Foundation?
Sure. I think, I guess the listeners, they can go to the podcast by going, we post it on my Substack site now, lawrencekraus.substack.com. Not only hosts the Origins Project Foundation, the podcast, but articles I'm writing on many, many subjects, including climate change. So I guess I'd suggest people go there or also to the Origins Project site, which is originsproject.org. And you'll be able to see all the things we're doing there. And as I say, you can get the last book from Amazon or hopefully any online realtor or retailer or maybe even at a local bookstore. And I guess I can't help but say, having just finished a new book, that next May you can get my new book, which is called The Known Unknowns at this point, which is what we know we don't know about the universe. And it's a lot broader. And I hope people enjoy that as well.
Well, I, for one, will encourage our listeners to learn a little bit more about you and about your books, because what I find in studying for you to prepare today and then even talking with you is very few people can tell the story. That's a complex story, but can tell it straightforwardly and in a truthful way without a bias. And I think you've done that very well. So I commend you. And I'm just really glad to have you our guest today on Path to Zero. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, I'd also say to you and your listeners, come on some of our trips, or if you live near Phoenix, come to some of our public events. But it's been a pleasure, and I appreciate the questions and the opportunity to talk about this subject.
That wraps up this episode of Path to Zero. And a quick reminder, if you want to send me a note to comment on an episode or give me a new topic to consider, just shoot me an email. The address is path2zero, that's path, the word two, zero, @propane.com. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn, and I always look forward to hearing from you. With that, a big thank you to everyone listening. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.